Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf, using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show David Paul Kuhn. I originally interviewed David about his most recent book called The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. That book, by the way, is, I think it's now out in paperback or will be soon. And in doing my research for that interview, I came across a previous book David had written that I already had, and it's very relevant to our political times, as his most recent one. I finally got around to reading it, and it's really worth focusing on today. The book is called The Neglected Voter, White Men and the Democratic Dilemma, and it's remarkably prescient about the role of gender in voting from the opposite perspective of what is the most prevalent focus. We'll get into all that. David looks at this issue from the angle of white men and shows how Democrats lost this group and continue to ignore them at their own peril. David, thank you so much for coming back on.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Well, this was brought up in a couple of recent interviews, most recently with James Carville a couple weeks ago when he talked about feminization of the Democratic Party. And I immediately thought of you and thought this would be good timing to bring you back to talk about your first book. But what you talk about, you know, we've heard about the gender gap for a long time, but you look at, and everybody looks at it from the women's perspective. But what's overlooked is what's called the white male gap. What is that, and when did that come about?
Sure. So one way to think about it is that that book was the story of the other side of the gender gap. So when the gender gap emerged as sort of a mainstream media fixation and political fixation in the 1980s, for generations after, it was always thought about in terms of why do Democrats win women or why do Republicans do badly with women. But the other side of that story was also true, that Democrats were doing bad with men, and few, were, if anyone, was asking why did Democrats lose men, overwhelmingly working and middle-class white men. So the white male gap was the outcome of that. And the trends that were true for white men are beginning to happen with Hispanic and black men as well. But overwhelmingly, what's going on or what went on was that beginning in the 1960s and 70s, the parties began to resort. And one of the outcomes was that Democrats overwhelmingly lost middle and working class whites. But what was not talked about was that they were overwhelmingly men. And part of that was that Republicans actually historically had a very strong base of white women. And so when deindustrialization happened and all the cultural changes of the 60s and 70s, Democrats barely noticed, and noticed all too late, that they were overwhelmingly losing men, blue-collar white men, fundamentally.
And why, I mean, and I'll be honest with my listeners here and you, I had to keep going back and reminding myself that this book was written in 2007. Some things have changed, and we'll get into that, but how remarkable this was in seeing the future and the struggles that the party has. But why is this important? There are those in the Democratic Party who, as you know, who think, we need to get a coalition of the ascendant to win. We don't really need to worry about working class men, white men in particular. Why is this so important?
And that's what elected Donald Trump. Yeah. I mean, I've started arguing against that consensus. You know, two generations ago, I kept pointing out in 2004 that had John Kerry narrowed the, you know, white male gap only 5 points, he would have gained more than 2 million votes and won the presidency. And, you know, that was 2004. So, you know, that stale way of thinking, that relying on an ascendant Democrat, what was called, quote unquote, the ascendant America, effectively a non-white, a rising, you know, minority, majority, and so forth, that investment in political capital largely went broke. And it was not only responsible for the election of Donald Trump, but it's been responsible for, you know, Democrats' greatest travails, including how they eventually would lose the Supreme Court and lead to such whirlwinds that ultimately hurt the left the most, such as the Roe decision recently. And so, I mean, the problem is that it never happened. The country, for many reasons, was unwinnable if you were a party that positioned yourself as for everyone but whites or everyone but white men. And what I mean by that is that if you're thinking about politics in terms of identity groups and victimization, and you're thinking about politics in terms of this is a framework in which you're thinking about us versus them, then inevitably, if you're going to speak up for, if you're going to say you're for, you know, let me step back. You know, there's a quote from the book that you talked about before in my book, The Hard Hat Riot, where I quote Fred Harris, this Democratic populist from decades ago. He said that the blue-collar worker will be progressive as long as it is not progress for everyone but himself. And gradually, the message of liberalism was progress and empathy for everyone but whites, but white men, but the white working class. And eventually, beginning in the 80s and onward, the left began to frame both America, both masculinity, white men, as being defined by their worst attributes. And that way of thinking led to the whirlwind of this identity politics, which was the election of Donald Trump.
So were there specific issues, David, that led to this, or was it cultural differences or themes or what was it that really, or were there specific candidates that kind of provided contrast that caused men? And you point this out, white men used to be the core of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all those things, right? It was issues, it was themes, it was changes in America, economic changes, and so debates over culture, crime, race, national security sort of began to restore the electorate beginning in the 60s and 70s. And basically by 1972, I quote a Democratic counsel in my book, Harry McPherson, where he talks about how Democratic primary convention, remember, this is 1972. I just want everyone to realize that. He talks about how Democratic, I'm going to paraphrase, but Democratic primaries and conventions often rocks the language of rebuke. Very like, it occurred to me, this is Harry McPherson speaking, a Johnson confidant, that the language many wives use in speaking to their husbands, particularly toward the end of marriage, is you never think of the children or my mother or me, only yourself. And if you substituted his, I'm paraphrasing, the disadvantaged or the homeless or whatever group you choose, basically you had this reaction where, you know, the white men, you know, said they're going off for smokes and abandoned the Democratic Party and stick with that paradigm. And, you know, as this sort of, at the same time that this gender shift is happening, there's, of course, this class shift. And the Democratic Party and the Republican Party begin to resort along class lines until we fundamentally have a total inversion. And whereas the white working class overwhelmingly were the base of Johnson's electoral landslide in 1964, by, you know, 2016, they are overwhelmingly the base of Donald Trump's coalition. And they are more male than female, and they are more working class than not. And by working class, I, of course, mean blue collar, lacking, you know, generally the vernacular is that it lacking in a college degree or more, which is basically the best shorthand we have in American life for class politics.
I would assume that the talk these days of white male privilege, which I see a lot on social media, it plays right into this, because I, there's probably a lot of white male working class people that think, what? I mean, what privilege do I have?
Yeah. So it's very hard to overstate how much damage that's done and has done. I mean, this goes back, first of all, you know, let's just remind the kids, this is not new. right? The fixation of the media in the mid-90s was the quote-unquote angry white male. And it was on the cover of every major magazine. There were all these articles, every cover articles, the TV networks fixated on it, the mainstream media fixated on it. And what was happening was, you know, white men were being described by their worst attributes to explain why they were no longer with the Democratic Party. It was racism, it was bigotry, it was sexism, it was this, it was having to press two for English. This literally was, you know, in cover stories of Newsweek at the time, when, at a time when the news weeklies were highly influential, and most other American media. The problem with this talk is that it bled by our time. It bled into this talk of white male privilege. And fundamentally, as I pointed out in the first book I wrote in the early 2000s and in my most recent book, The Hard Hat Riot, you know, it was largely, it was been based on mythologies. For one, for two generations, for more than two generations, the average Asian man has been earning more than the average white man in American life. You know, between the 1989 and 2016, the share of American families who were, you know, of the white working class decreased by a fifth, but their portion of the nation's wealth fell by half. American men fundamentally were not earning more in Trump's day than they were earning in Nixon's day. Their wages had stagnated. And, you know, while all this went on, you know, the deindustrialization of American life, that the average American man's standard of living, including especially white men, rose at a slower rate than any previous time since the Civil War, that, you know, men's earnings were not increasing, that the Great Recession would be fundamentally a blue-collar crisis that was hitting white men most as a percentage. You know, while all this is going on, the left took up this vernacular of white male privilege, presuming that you know, the guy who's working check to check, who's helping to support his family, who also sees himself pushed down by the man who maybe saw his son go to Iraq for a cause that he doesn't quite ever understand or see as worth his son's life, perhaps saw his neighbors, you know, go through an addiction crisis that was largely ignored by American elites, perhaps saw generations of great economists go on the mainstream media and talk about how global trade was good because it made products cheap. And, you know, perhaps after being ignored for generations, this guy is a little sick of being called privileged when nothing about his life feels privileged. And in many cases, you know, he's living with the same hard scrabble life that black and brown suffer through, and that the Democratic Party had and still could speak in a way in which talked about what unites rather than what divides these groups, they would be a lot better off, and perhaps so in America.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author David Paul Kuhn, who's written some really, really good books. His most recent one, which was the focus of a show back in February, is called The Hard Hat Riot, Nixon, New York City, and the Dawn of the White Working Class Revolution. I highly recommend that one. And as I was explaining earlier in my research on David, I came across an earlier book he wrote in 2007 called The Neglected Voter, White Men and the Democratic Dilemma, which is just remarkable in the stories it tells. And it's heavily researched, backed up by data, polling, on the Democrats' problems with white males. And it continues to this day. And I want to ask you, I mean, here again, Carville referenced the feminization of the party. But that was a term I saw in your book that Kevin Phillips used all the way back in 68. Has it become, is it remained that way where, this term, the feminization of the Democratic Party, has that hurt the party? I mean, I suppose on the opposite end, the Republican Party is the masculine party. How do you see how that's applying to today's politics?
Well, both first of, you know, I've written a lot about this, about, you know, what I call the mommy and daddy party. And, you know, in different contexts, it hurts both parties. Right during at the dawn of the Great Recession, it provided an impossible amount of baggage for John McCain. He simply could not get out from under the stereotype and perception of the Republican Party as the daddy party, and therefore less interested in the safety net, and less interested in a springboard, and less interested in active government to help people get out of this terrible economic circumstances. But by, you know, late 2009 and 2010, the Democratic Party started to suffer from being, you know, that mommy party schema, right? And so, in the sense that they were, you know, they were not, they sort of almost in many ways came to be seen as the worst of both worlds. They were neither paying enough attention to the economic crisis, nor were they willing to take on sort of see government as a force for order. And, you know, writ large, over the last, half century, the parties began to resort, not only through these class and gender lines, but effectually a schema that was so familiar because it was familial, right? The daddy party viewed government as a force for order, that, you know, government exists to prevent harm, whether to life or way of life, and the mommy party views government as a means to feel safe, that, you know, Washington is there to provide a freedom from jeopardy and nurture citizens. And in both cases, you know, this can help this stereotype can help the parties in different political things and can hurt the parties. Now, obviously, when there was upheaval throughout the United States, whether the rise in crime or disorder, whether it's the 1970s or most recently in the last couple of years, that Democrats faced the downside of their stereotype where on criminal justice issues. And Republicans have, you know, dealt with the same. But today, you know, the Democratic Party suffers from a left that can't even speak about masculinity in a positive sense. And lets terms like, quote unquote, toxic masculinity effectively define the word masculinity. And so, like, as critical theory in academia migrates into the prestige press and the cultural mainstream by the 80s, 90s, and today, you know, not only is America defined by its worst attributes, but so are men, and so is masculinity. And, you know, eventually people notice. They might not care about the little fights, the academic disputes, the rhetoric, but they kind of notice if you keep speaking up for everyone but them, or you keep describing intrinsic attributes such as their sex in a negative light. And, you know, this partly explains why Democrats are starting to see some of the problems they saw with white men, now with black men and Hispanic men.
The book, again, was written in 2007, and I've talked about how remarkably prescient it is. Update us. Since then, you know, you talk in that in the book about the elections of 2008 coming up, when Obama was elected, and he was reelected, of course, and then Biden was elected in 2020. Kind of update for our listeners your thoughts on the role men played perhaps in those victories, and maybe what they did differently, or did they just benefit from other factors in order to win?
Sure. Well, firstly, not since 1976 with Jimmy Carter had any Democrat won more than 38% of white men, with one exception, and that was a black man with a Muslim name. Right, Barack Obama in 2008 won about, like, you know, these numbers were never, it's polling in the end, but like 40%, 41%, the first one to break this ceiling that has haunted Democrats for 50 years. And he did that in large part because of the Great Recession, and it provided a context for Democrats to make historic inroads with blue-collar whites, and especially blue-collar white men. Now, the peril for Democrats was that they didn't recognize how much the Great Recession was tied into Obama's majority and his ascension to the presidency. But since then, the problem has both remained the same and gotten worse, in the sense that it's, you know, Joe Biden effectively won the same share of white men as John Kerry and Al Gore and Bill Clinton. But the white working class men and those middle class men who, you know, have felt estranged, forgotten or alienated from the Democratic Party, you know, who felt that way 20 years ago, the problems are deeper. The fault lines are deeper. they've just been, you know, after, you know, a generation being called, defined as angry white men, defined by the worst attributes, you know, has now seeped into the modern idea of white male privilege or white privilege. And for those people who don't feel privileged and whose life is not a privilege, it just, you know, the wounds deepen because, you know, I often paraphrase this old line that people don't forget, you know, that people maybe don't remember, you know, what hurt them, but they remember how you made them feel. And right. For the Democratic Party, whether it's with the white working class or many of these working class white men or middle class white men, people just know that they've kind of been defined as the antagonist of progress for a half century. And if you define any group by their worst attributes, you know, eventually they notice. And, you know, a little bit of tax policy or some incentive here or there, you know, or showing John Kerry in a military uniform or having Joe Biden say some very nice things in the 2020 election about forgetting the working class, it's just not going to break through. It takes a generational change. It takes having the right people in the room. It takes recognizing where things went wrong. And I'm not convinced the Democratic Party, well, I should say that the left, that the powers that be on the left care enough about it. There has, of course, been some recognition of this problem since Trump was elected. And there's this ongoing dispute in the Democratic Party. Is it race? Is it class? Of course, it's many things. And there's not one grand unifying theory or grand unifying explanation of why Democrats lose these voters. But one thing that definitely is wrong is a simplistic assumption that just because someone's not with you, it's because of something wrong with them. That every reason that someone does not choose to vote for you must be defined by everything that's wrong with them. And this idea, this blame the voter for not liking you doesn't work in politics, just like it doesn't work in a relationship if you want to pass things up by saying it's all your spouse's fault or all your girlfriend's fault or all your boyfriend's fault. And until that happens, and until there's some like profound recognition plus some good policy, the same problems that haunted Democrats in the 70s and 80s and 90s and 2010s will remain, and it will migrate from whites to Hispanics, and it's already starting to.
I really like how you draw in like cultural references, like movies, because you describe the model, say, for Democratic men being Humphrey Bogart going way back. And then that was updated to Alan Alda in the 70s, the more sensitive male type. And you point out, and sometimes I wonder if the Democratic researchers really get stuff, because you point out that suburban men, which I think a lot of folks maybe try to portray as left of center, drive pickup trucks, and they like John Wayne, too. So there's this whole misreading, I think, of male culture. And what one of the best parts of the book, I thought, was the interplay of guns and abortion from a gender perspective, if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, just to jump off the point you just made, it's not only that, you know, they drive pickups too, but it is not helped by the fact that in the mainstream media, if you're a male, you get automatic cultural status if you'll just start ragging on your own sex, right? So just like, you know, they'll just, and that attribute, like even describing masculinity as not a negative term, is almost anathema to what is expected of you when you go on air in the prestige press today. And I can speak from experience. In terms of abortion and guns, you know, it's very complicated because in some ways abortion is misunderstood, right? For example, abortion views do not break down strongly between men and women. In other words, men and women generally hold similar views on abortion. And the biggest group of socialist conservatives who fought abortion for the last few decades were not men, they were actually women. In terms of how they break down along party lines, along gender lines, I mean, both issues at their deepest concern senses of freedom. And when those who believe most in the issue, whether it's abortion rights or gun rights, view any loss of that freedom as a risk to the total loss of that freedom, then you have very little room for compromise. And you combine that with a country that has this unfortunate two-party system where everything is defined by this blue and red tribe, it just is a recipe for lax compromise and increasing vitriol and division. And until, you know, we can, and we as in Americans can sort of, you know, acknowledge the realities not only of these debates, but also that also maybe push aside the most extreme voices in these debates, you know, little progress will be made on any of these issues. And until, and to some degree, pulling these issues away from freedom and more towards, you know, reasonable compromises that most Americans believe in, whether it's guns and or abortion, you know, will allow for some progress on these issues.
We just have like a couple minutes left, David. We're not going to get to everything. I will say that you were remarkably farsighted in saying, you know, in your final chapter on what the Democrats need to do, one of the points you said was an Apollo program for energy security. Boy, wouldn't things be different now if that had taken place? But my final question is just to ask you, if there are some Democrats out there that listeners, people interested in politics on the Democratic side want to look to, for those who have handled this issue best. I mean, back then you had mentioned a couple senators that were just elected, John Tester from Montana and Jim Webb from Virginia. Are there others? Do you want, if you can update that list a little bit?
I mean, there aren't many. You know, one name that comes to mind is Tim Ryan in Ohio, but there really aren't many. And, you know, I don't want to, if I start naming five people, I'll leave out the six. But in the end, the fact is, I'm still going to be in single digits. You know, there's just not that many national Democrats who, you know, both have a standing and willingness to take on these issues. I mean, some of it became a little less politically incorrect after Trump was elected. There was some recognition about class lines and that the white working class is going through many of the same struggles as the non-white working class. But in the end, there's still an overarching tension in speaking about the coalition, even in this era of the Joe Biden presidency, in a way that unites people in common struggle, and rather than in the divisions of every American tribe.
Well, it's certainly, I think you've nailed the key challenge facing Democrats and in some ways also the Republicans on how gender has played out, and especially to the Democrat detriment of the Democrats with white males. But I'll just close by saying again to listeners, if you really want to get a good read on this, pick up both of these books, The Neglected Voter and David's more recent book, The Hard Hat Riot, which just came out on in paperback. David, I can't thank you enough, and look forward to your future work, and thank you again for being a guest today.
Well, I really appreciate you having me. I hope you have a great day.